miss you when I
Welcome back, everyone. For today, I'm actually joined with Kat Kinsman of Tinfoil Swans and Food and Wine. We're going to discuss Gerson Hayward. But before we dive much further into it, I'll hand over the mic so she can introduce herself further.
Hey, I am Kat. Thank you so much for having me on this. When you sent me a note, I was super touched because Twin Peaks is such a long-standing passion for me. I was in high school when I started watching, so pretty much the exact same age as Laura Palmer. And something in it really hit me that somebody my age was being represented on TV and in such a traumatic fashion in a way, but also something that aesthetically rocked my world and explored her deep interiority, you know, of a character who basically was gone and hadn't been there. It deeply embedded in my psyche in a way that still all these years later, I feel plucking out. So I was absolutely so thrilled that you reached out to come on there to talk about a character. But this character of Gerson Hayward lodged into my psyche in a way that I didn't even really understand until she made her return so many years later. But so this is all to say, I've been living with Twin Peaks in my heart, my head, my brains, my veins for all of this time, to the point where I have built a red room in my home. And sadly, I'm not recording from there today, but it is where my heart is. And for my day job, I am executive features editor at Food and Wine. And like I said, I host the Tinfoil Swans podcast. We have finished up the first season of it. There are actually Twin Peaks references in it for Easter eggs for people who want to find them. So this all goes to say, this is so many of my passions coming together, and I'm really, really grateful to be here.
And I think the first thing to start off is that the first thing I have in my notes is that we see Gerson in, at the end of the season two premiere. What I think is so distinct is that she dresses as a fairy princess for a school play. But the thing that I really gravitate to is the fact that I think this is a reference to Glenda, the Good Witch from Wizard of Oz.
Same page. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think that what I think is so interesting is that Lynch, he did Wild at Heart. Like, I don't know the exact time frame. He did it after the pilot of Twin Peaks, and then he did Wild at Heart. He came back, of course, to do episode two for season one of Twin Peaks. But you think that after doing a feature film that's explicitly a love letter to Wizard of Oz, that he would just try to find a new thing. But what do you think of the correlation of like Gerson Hayward and Glenda, and like what makes you think Lynch like wanted to pick this in particular for Gerson?
So when I think of Glenda, and it's funny because I actually have a picture of myself, like probably right around when Fire Walk With Me came out, where I am dressed as Glenda at a friend. My boss was going off to art school in Kansas. So we threw a themed party for her. Somebody was dressed as Dorothy, I was dressed as Glenda. But the thing that you are doing as Glenda is welcoming somebody into a strange and magical place. You're a force of good. You're an entree. You're a safe entree into a place of danger when you are being Glenda there. It's referenced both in this pink dress that she's got on. She's got a sparkly tiara. And it could be something that could be seen as being kind of frivolous and, hey, fairy princess culture and things. But at the same time, she's trying to give it the gravitas of saying that she has come first in English and math exams. And then she says something that actually really stuck in my heart, because she says to her sisters, because there's the precedence of them having excelled in those things as well, I don't have to worry about being ashamed anymore. And there, for these characters who are being welcomed into this other place, there is something about not feeling right where you are, not feeling somehow as if you are, I don't know, fitting. There's something asynchronous about like where you happen to be, and to have a character who is there and benign and welcoming you in is really, really significant to me. And yeah, something can be seen as frivolous or something, but it shows to me that Gerson is containing multitudes there. You know, she has dressed for the occasion. She wants to welcome everybody to, you know, the Hayward Supper Club. She has done her homework about what that entails. And I think that's a really, really special role for her to have, because chaos is about to happen. She doesn't know it, but there is about to be a breaking of worlds that is happening right in front of her, and people might not understand at that particular time. But I feel like she's a really benign presence in there. So the Glinda thing really, really stands out to me, and the fact that it's echoed in her wardrobe later too.
I'm actually glad you brought up the part about her grades in math and English, and how she says specifically to Donna and Harriet about how she's relieved to not feel ashamed anymore. One of the things I think about is that she's the youngest one, and so she looks up to her older sisters, that there's this expectation of you can't just be good, you have to be great. But I think this scene, and this is actually a little bit about Gerson and Harriet, but you see how Alicia Witt plays on the piano, and you can tell that she's very clearly trained with music, but I think what she brings with the piano, combined with Harriet's poem, this is something I think is like a lot more special than when I first watched it. Because as Gerson is playing, Harriet has her poem and she's talking about Laura and how Laura was laughing and dancing in her dreams. And it actually made me think that it almost feels like it's a follow-up to when Angelo Badalamenti, when he was talking about when he created the theme for Laura Palmer and how Lynch was describing him to her about how it's like there's this girl in the woods and like what's going through her mind.
David would sit here and I'd say, "Well, what do you see, David?" And David would say, "Okay, Angelo, we're in a dark woods now. And there's a soft wind blowing through some sycamore trees. And there's a moon out and there's some animal sounds in the background. And you can hear the hoot of an owl. And you're in the dark woods. You know, just get me into that beautiful darkness with the soft wind." And I started playing, and in David's mind you can just see that he was visualizing the description that he envisioned. Then he would say, "Okay, Angelo, now we got to make a change, because from behind a tree in the back of the woods there's this very lonely girl. Her name is Laura Palmer, and it's very sad, but get something that matches her." And I just segued into this. "It's very beautiful. I could see her. And she's walking towards the camera and she's coming closer. Just keep building it. Just keep building it. And she's getting close. Now reach some kind of climax." And I would go, and he said, "Oh, that's it. Oh, that's so beautiful. Angelo, oh, that's tearing my heart out. I love that. Just keep that going. Now she's starting to leave. So fall down. Keep falling, keep falling, keep falling. Now go back into the dark woods. That's it. Keep going."
And I could only think of this particular scene about almost as if it was a follow-up of like, she is okay. Like, you know, like even before Fire Walk With Me, that she is actually in a better place now.
I think of her, you know, sort of in the orb, as you know, as she is presented later on. She is this glowing. She is the antidote. She is all of these things. But again, there's that figure of protection that comes in the form of a Glinda. There's art and poetry and beauty surrounding her. But there's also giving somebody your art is a really profound thing to do. And it strikes me that these two younger girls have set up this entire scenario to be comfort to adults. That really stands out to me, that you see Harriet working on her poetry and trying to come up with the nuance of it to make sure that it is special and it is perfect. The fact that they say our friend Laura, so you know that it wasn't just Donna's friend, that Laura meant something to them as well, and it reinforces the nature of Laura in her caretaking of people, that she was beloved by people, that you know that they go over to comfort Leland after this and give themselves, because they know at this young age that can offer this to the adults in their world, which makes me think that doesn't come about by accident. Those traits come about in people when they come from a background of trauma and caretaking in a home. And while we, have these notions of the Hayward house as being, oh, this all-American kind of stuff, there is obviously all of this stuff roiling under the surface. So these two younger people have picked up on this. And you see that they're doing everything they can to comfort these people to the point where Gersten isn't eating during this. She's playing the piano to complement the dinner that is happening there. She has foregone food in order to be there and present and try to be some sort of counterbalance to the tragedy that all of these people have just been through. Maybe with a different actor, maybe with somebody else, it could have been sort of an obnoxious kid showing off or something like that. But no, you can tell that she has thoroughly steeped herself in this and that she and Harriet both have done this because this is their act of kindness and caretaking.
It's funny because to go a behind the scenes aspect, she was written in because Lynch worked with her on Dune and her mother was kind of asking for her to find work. Alicia Witt said this in Blue Rose a few years back for an interview. She said, "When I was 14, my mom came out with me. She called David to let him know that we were in LA. I suppose kind of hinting that if there were a role for me on Twin Peaks, I was around. He ended up writing that role for me to help me give a gig while I was in LA. It made a huge difference just because I was able to say I was in Twin Peaks and have that credit. Helped me get a lot more work and to get a good agent. It was a fantastic thing." I think it's actually remarkable how David, of course, because she was in the final act of Dune, that there was at least a working relationship and that Alicia Witt's mother was able to reach out to him. And he recreated this character that I think is actually very important to not only the scene we're talking about, but with everything pertaining to Leland and even the after credits. Because we were talking about the relationship with Laura, but I think it's worth addressing is that the music I think is a huge component for Leland as well. Because by this point, of course, none of the Haywards obviously they don't know about what Leland did to Laura, but they just know that there's something a little bit off about him. So when he starts saying, "Come on, get happy," and he's like going faster, Gerson Hayward's going faster alongside with it. But then like he, I think that Doc Hayward must have thought it was a heart attack of sorts, or that, of course there's something medically wrong with him. But before I get too much further on my thoughts, what did you think of this particular scene and what prompted this?
Going back just into some of that, having watched in the context of the whole episode, it's the one where Leland's hair had turned white and shocked everybody. And he has started to sing the songs in a way that maybe Leland hasn't before. He's singing Mare's Eat Oats earlier in this when he comes out into the living room and Maddie and his wife are there and they're looking at him in shock. And you don't really understand why until the camera turns around to him and his hair has just sort of been shocked white. Then he shows up and he manifests in this way in the Horns' office as well. The thing is with the Horn brothers, the way that they are processing it with him, they're operating on a different kind of level. He's not their caretaker, he's their lawyer. He's, in a different kind of way. And he comes in and he's doing a soft shoe number. And, he's singing and they're like getting up on the desk and dancing with them. So he's seeing his energy mirrored in them. And it's such a fascinating thing. So he goes from, the home where this is happening and it's a shock. And, Mare's Eat Oats is like a, it's a little language nonsense kind of song that he's sort of finding comfort in. And then I'm all of a sudden blanking out like what song it was that he was singing with the Horn brothers, but they were basically like justifying whatever he was doing because like this doesn't seem weird at all. Like they're maybe like surprised about the hair, but the fact that they're also dancing and singing along with him and just like, hey, this is just what's happening now. Are they writing it off? Are they just happy to see that somebody's as wacky as them? Maybe they've already started growing all that pot they're doing later. But then to have the music introduced at this dinner as well. That's again a thing that I, looking at their family and seeing that there must have been this sort of underlying trauma of this whole thing, and also I grew up with a mother with a movement disability who was sometimes in a wheelchair as well as Mrs. Hayward is there. And I found that something that I especially developed as a kid is this huge thing with like caretaking of her and spatial awareness of various things. So I had to sort of develop this extra sense of kind of monitoring how she was doing and how various adults in my life were doing because of, having to be protective of the way that she moved through space. So seeing her mirror Leland's quickening of pace with how that was singing, she's trying to make him not feel weird. She's trying to match him. She's trying to make him comfortable in his body. She's not rattled. She just can't keep up. She's a child at that point, and she's just trying to accommodate him in a way where people who have come from maybe a background where some of these things are happening are trying to do, sometimes almost to normalize. Sometimes it's to mask, sometimes it's to normalize, but it's just what you're used to. So it might not occur to her that this is odd at all, that she is sitting off to the side as they're all eating this dinner that I think it's supposed to be comforting to people. It looks stomach churning to me. I have never seen that many baby carrots in my entire life altogether. But I think it's this meal that is supposed to be these tremendously comforting things, that there's this sort of, gray. Sorry, I'm a food writer, so I notice the food about these things. But there's a bounty on the table. There are all these slabs of what looks to be roast beef cooked to gray, as probably is. I don't know if it happens because it was long stewed and done with care. That is one thing. If it's happened because it's just kind of and depressing, that's another. There are giant piles of mashed potatoes. There's peas. There's really an incomprehensible amount of cooked carrots there as well. Everybody is a little bit in their cups by the time this happens, because when you first sort of see that the supper club is happening, the adults are all drinking very, very careful cocktails in really appropriate little stemware. I really love tiny cocktail glasses that are specifically for what's in them. There are coupe glasses, there are other things, but there's what looks to be maybe an old fashioned in one of them. I believe there's a martini in another. So the adults have started drinking already at the beginning of this. By the time they get to the dinner table, it has, and she's playing some Mendelssohn there. That is, I went and looked at that piece, and apparently it's notoriously pretty difficult to play. But all of the adults are responding to the talent of these girls. The teenagers are rolling their eyes, like, really, we're doing this, really. But by the time they move to dinner, they have switched to wine. So the adults are mostly drinking wine out of goblets. There is a tumbler of water on the table, and then Harriet is drinking a glass of milk. And I found that to be really, really poignant. So we can infer from all of this that the adults are, they've probably ingested a certain amount by this point. So when he gets up to, start singing, maybe everybody's a little bit loose by then, but you can kind of guarantee that the only people in the room who are approaching this to some degree of sobriety, because we don't know if Laura's stoned at that point or not, or, what any of them has done, but the children are the only ones who are probably completely sober. And they're seeing this happen in its full horror. And it just is poignant. It breaks my heart. I see Gersten trying her best and breaking a little bit there.
One of the things I was thinking of with Gersten, I kind of figured that when Leland was starting to go off, saying come on, get happy a little too fast, she was just doing the best she could to match along with it and hoping to see where it goes. But I think what makes me think of this scene is that after this, we end with the season two finale with Ronette, with her nightmare about Laura being killed and Bob emerging. And I think that it's very uniquely jarring because you have the, like, what is, in my opinion, one of the most terrifying parts in all of the original series. But then it could have cut to Laura's homecoming photo like any other episode, but it cuts back to Gersten playing piano. I have actually thought about this on and off for months now, but did you have any thoughts about why this scene was put in the after credits?
It's, I noticed some of the technical reason of why she's playing that, because apparently David Lynch had seen her on the show That's Incredible, and she was playing. And I read an interview, his initial interest in her, and then put her in Dune with that. But, she was at that point a competitive piano player and really just incredibly well versed. In this interview, she couldn't remember, she had been playing like a boogie-woogie during something, because they had this existing relationship. So I want to think it was maybe during Dune, or I don't know if it was in that original, like, That's Incredible performance of hers, but he had seen her do it, and then he asked her to do that on camera. So he just happened to film her playing that, or maybe it was like between a scene and she was just doing that too. So he happened to capture that. So that was, I think that was just kind of a real moment that happened, as opposed to a character moment that might have been like an Alicia Witt kind of moment. Like, it's, I'd be so curious to find out why that happened, but it's because he knew she could do it. So it's not something he made her knew. He knew that she already kind of could. And that actually links back to the notion that this actually really, really struck me, is Leland was just able to say, get happy to Gersten, and she knew it. So she clearly has this training where she is familiar with a canon of like American standards, so she can play a boogie-woogie, she can play a Get Happy, which, again, the significance of that and like how that became Judy Garland's song, and a lot of, there's a lot of stuff going on there. But under the credits, it is I was trying to think if there are a few maybe other times when there's something other than the usual under the credits. And I was trying to remember maybe there's something with, the log lady, maybe there's something there. I should have like done homework on that. But the tonal jarrings of that is really, really stands with me. And to know that that probably was not, that might have been sort of an after. I'd be curious to find out how that decision happened, but it strikes me also just it's a moment that is both about the actress and the character.
I think the reason why I hone in on this is that for most of the Lynch-directed episodes, he's very deliberate about having like alternate credits because, we get the Laura Palmer homecoming photo, but, in episode two, we have the Man from Another Place dancing. We have Gersten playing the piano in this. Cooper with the superimposed red curtains after Maddie's killed. This season two finale with Laura, or doppelganger Laura, rather, her face emerging from the reflection of the coffee. So I think Lynch is very deliberate about these things. And I think for me, I kind of view it as that the moment that Leland falls down is roughly the same time Ronette's having her nightmare, that there's this connection of like Bob and Leland. And I know that's a whole topic of, like how much of Leland is Bob, if it's like if it's fantastical or if it's all Leland. But there's just something about those scenes and how we cycle back is that for me, it's hard to overlook that what happens with Ronette is happening during this dinner scene. And there's something about Leland's new idiosyncratic behavior that's kind of it's kind of a chicken or egg sort of situation. But I think there's at least a connection and that Gersten is like unknowingly a center point for it.
I mean, they're all on an electrical grid together. So, to me, Gersten, because of the way that she shows up again later, because of the palpable difference when she shows up later, and because she has an ambiguous ending, because, as we see in the final dossier, like she leaves and she's not heard from again. There are the characters who cross back and forth between the worlds. And I think of her a lot later when she's in the return and the last we sort of physically see of her. She is looking up into the canopy above her in the same way that other characters do in those places where things are porous. I, in my heart, believe that she is somebody who transcends the various worlds there. I would not be surprised to see her walking in and out of the lodge, or actually, I had said this before we started recording, but I really feel that so much of the work of Lynch is just different rooms off of off of the lodge and through all of there. And I think she is somebody who inhabits all of these different realms and is porous. And there's something in Leland that maybe sees this as well, because I also fundamentally feel that she's the parallel Laura in so many ways. And I think as we see these cycles playing out over and over and over again, because what happened with Leland and Laura is timeless and exists basically outside of time and space and is repeated ad infinitum. I've read theories about how Gersten is potentially after the events of the final dossier, if she is the Laura later. And it would not surprise me because they're both people who exhibit the same traits. They are kind, they are thoughtful, they are attuned, and there is something, they have a switch in them that gets flipped and activated, and they are sensitive to other things. So I think she's another person who is porous in that particular way.
We were talking about behind the scenes of Alicia Witt, and I think this applies to Jessica Lunfels, who plays Harriet. But I think it's interesting is that we only see Gersten in this episode, and we only see Harriet in the pilot and this episode. I mean, obviously, there's behind the scenes aspects, but do you think it thematically works that we don't see them throughout the original series, or even Firewalk Me, or the missing pieces for that matter?
Yeah, I actually do because I think from what we know of what happens to Harriet, eventually, like she walled herself off. She wanted to participate as little as possible. She is not lodge bound. She thrived by getting away. And by all accounts, she is the member of the Hayward family who fared the best out of everything because, she went off, I believe she's a, went off to be a vet. canonically and escaped and doesn't really come back. Whereas Gersten was drawn back and took care of her mother. And, you know, and Donna sort of canonically later, like really, really struggled with, you know, substance use disorder and various other things. And I believe in this palpable gravity that so much of Twin Peaks has, and especially for female characters who it, I don't know if it exacerbates any pre-existing mental illness or, you know, any other things that they might have, or if it causes. But if you look back at how many of the characters in it have spent time in institutions for mentally related conditions and things, the draw of this thing, I think because the veil is so thin, there either like really draws them down and calls them into service of it and really tends to ignite things with them, and they're inexorably drawn to it, like the fact that like Gersten like really crumbled once she moved away from it, and then there are people who thrive once they're away from it, so like Harriet. So I like to think that she made this escape, and if she went back it would undo her. And to me, with the gravitational force of that to Gersten, it was inevitable. We didn't need to see because it was just going to happen anyway.
I think for me, my headcanon, if I can refer to it as that, is that I look at Gersten and Harriet is that they're always so busy with after school activities that we just happen to not see them after that. So I think it works up until that point. But I think the thing that's worth mentioning is that after the events of the season two finale, with Ben Horn being the biological father of Donna, this was hidden not from Donna, but also Harriet and Gersten. And the fact that Doc Hayward splits Ben Horn's head open, and you know that there's a whole thing in the final dossier about like every event that was going on, but with this, he was clearly lying about what was going on, and that like ripped the family apart. So you're mentioning stuff like parallels with Gersten and Laura, but I feel like this is where it really comes in because you know, of course, unlike Doc Hayward, he's a much better father than Leland. I know it's a low bar, but he's a good person who did bad things. But I still think that for Gersten. The reason why I'm bringing this up is that in the final dossier, Tammy talks about how Gersten was a genius and musical prodigy. She graduated high school at 16 and was in fluent in four languages. She attended Stanford. She couldn't adapt to college life, even to the point of having a collapse and a nervous breakdown. She got into drugs and opioids, and then her mother's death in 2009 was even more just like it just made it so much harder. And then she had multiple sexual relationships later on with Steven, who we'll talk about. Just a lot of stuff that like ramifications from that night that like damaged her life from then on.
Oh, it's not from that night. That was just the inevitable outcome of the buried secrets to me. I mean, the fact that it was a family where these things could happen and where there were these deeply buried secrets, like that's just part of the fabric of this family the whole time. And having like the pressure of the older sisters who were such, you know, they achieved so many things academically, and you know, at least we can see from Don, you know, there's a popularity. There's a lot of family dynamics that were happening there as well, you know. And as somebody, you know, who had a mother with mobility issues and things too, there's a certain amount of like caretaking that happens there too, and a center of gravity that happens from that. Because if you're a person who, you know, sometimes it can happen that you're put in a position as a caretaker of your parent in a particular way. And if that is some of the dynamic, like they all are very, very protective of their mother. And then to have that polarity reversed, to find out that she, you know, some things had come about because of her actions and that she had been so lied to, that just happened to come to a head that night. Like that's, it wasn't because she saw her father spill blood. It wasn't because of any of these, to find out that her sister was only biologically half her sister. She knew in her bones. They all did. Somehow they really, really did. And sometimes the reaction to some of this is to completely separate, and some of it is to become exceptional. And sometimes you become exceptional so you can leave early. And it feels like that is some of what she was maybe trying to do, because she graduated early, both because she was this gifted, but also she worked really hard toward it. She both had the dynamic of she didn't want to be ashamed anymore. And that was the thing, is like, what led up to anymore? So what had been the things, like, had she had shame before? Was there something where she wasn't seen as good enough? I don't know, just all of those things were there. The trauma happened to spill out, the secrets spilled out, but it's not like any of that thing, that part was new, but the rest was not.
Now that you say it like that, I do have to say is that I think of like how I was saying about with Doc Hayward, how him splitting Ben Hort's head open was a thing that set it off. But I might have mentioned it was either my Donna episode or my Doc Hayward episode, but I think the real telling moment was that it was before Miss Twin Peaks when Donna explicitly questions both her parents about it.
Oh,
And she
yeah.
says something, she's like, "You raised me to tell the truth. I expect you both to do the same." And so they have this window of opportunity to just tell everything to either avert all this pro all these issues or at least mitigate them, but they don't. So the thing is that for Gersten and Harriet, more so Gersten in this case, that if that has to fall into question of like if their parents won't like even under direct question mention something, what will this mean of like for her and her sister's lives, and like how much can they really trust them from then onward?
I think you said they were like good parents and stuff, and I think they were as good as they could be, like to the degrees that they were able to do. I mean, I think when I think of Doc Hayward, I think of Laura going over to the Hayward house because she felt safe there, and him being incredibly parental there. And there's a comfort, there's an ease. They're both sitting there at that table, and yeah, they're rolling their eyes because they want to go out and hang out with, their do whatever it is they were going to go off and do. I don't know, go and stare at James. I think there's something like pretty significant in there, but it's, a very safe place. So I think the parents, like, they did the best that they could, but they are still human beings, and who wouldn't be upset to find out that, their partner not only, had this affair with somebody who they find to be kind of reprehensible, like really, like, I came to really love Ben Horn later, but he's a piece of crap in many, many ways. So to not just have that, but to have, your spouse be with somebody repugnant, and to find out that, like, a living reminder, a living daily living evidence of somebody in your house that came forth from that is, that's a lot to bear. And the fact that he never treated Donna less, he never treated her as anything other than his own flesh and blood, I think is really significant. So for them to have lapses or, moments of weakness or something like that, where they just couldn't, they'd had to develop this elaborate fiction to be able to survive every day. So I don't so much really blame them for this, because this is the undoing of how old is Donna, like how many years of having to keep this. It just can't come down in one night.
One thing is to mention about Gersten in the final dossier is that all this stuff, it seems like it lines up pretty well with her character, but we all know that with Tammy, she's kind of going off of like bad information in the secret history and the final dossier. Did you think there was anything that didn't quite line up, or maybe she got something wrong accidentally?
I mean, Tammy, like as we saw, was her brain was getting more and more muddied as, because we also saw, like, as she was leaving, her head was, things were starting to fade. So, with somebody like Gersten, who, again, I have my suspicions of maybe where she was for various times, there's some of these characters, there's sort of like a field around them, almost like they carry the lodge with them. They carry all of that kind of stuff. So to move away from the source of power is a thing for that. But like the fact that Tammy mentions, at the end that the stuff was starting to become really blurry to her, it wouldn't surprise me if the actual events were blurry too, because Gersten left and had all these things happened to her in this sort of interregnum of it. But what was happening to her while she was away? What was happening to her that she had this breakdown? She had been involved in all of these activities and things. And, and again, if she was young, especially younger when she moved away from home and moving away from structure, but also like the chaos that had happened, she's removed from her usual support systems of things. Think she gets to college, she's younger than everybody else. She can't go out to bars, she can't do whatever. So she's having to kind of probably exist in her own head, and she's out of that structure. And then if she's a person who also is becoming blurry, or, having that because she is away from that thing, that, that electrical force that she is used to, if Tammy is getting things wrong, what is actually real and what is right? It's really, really muddy in there. If she's having these affairs, and it seems like, it mentioned that her affair with Stephen had predated and intersected his marriage to Becky. And if that's the sort of person she's going for, somebody who is significantly younger than her as well, because if she's, I know there's a difference in age in the actors and things, but how did their paths cross? Drugs, Obviously, I think that is one of those things. But what is he looking to her for? What is she looking to him for? I think the truth of whatever happened to her that could be written down by somebody like Tammy, who's trying to just approach things with a very, fact-based gimlet eye on these things. Like, how do you write something definitive about something that is really fuzzy? So any of these things could be true.
I do think that for the most part, the whole Donna Hayward and of course the Gerson parts of the final dossier, they track well enough. But the problem is that the beginning of the Donna segment says, arriving in New York City in 1992, Donna Hayward began taking undergraduate classes at Hunter College. She had just turned 18. Now, there's a lot that's just wrong with just those first two sentences alone. And it sets a precedent that even though everything else seems like it could be relatively consistent, it does just make me think of like how much can she get right if she can't get like the years or the age right for Donna? And how does this carry over to Gersten?
So 1992, that would be okay. So was Donna, was she a junior or a senior?
I always figured that she was like 17, at least by February of 1989. If she's in the same class with Laura, she would have to be 17. I always took it that that class was like seniors, that they were 17, turning 18, if that it would be roughly that age.
But what if she's a prodigy like her younger sister and maybe skipped a year? If Gersten is trying to keep up with her sisters academically, she might be a little bit younger. Laura treats her like she's younger. I am the Muffet. These things where she really is saying like, you're milk and cookies or whatever it was that she happened to say. So she treats Donna like she's younger, which leads me to think like she easily could be because of when people are born in the year, you can be in somebody in the same academic year as them and they can be a full year younger than you. So I know that Hunter also does early admission. Like weirdly, I live in New York, and I've had friends who go there. So you can get in there early, like if you're doing that. So it might actually line up because I think you can start. I want to make sure I get this right because like there was a young woman who I knew her when she was in high school, and she started at Hunter College for creative writing. And I'm just trying to remember if she started taking some classes before she actually started school there. So it is entirely possible, or if she joined, somehow got there because she clearly wanted to escape home. So did she then maybe start in what would have been the academic second semester and go there? But there are, a lot of ways to take college courses without actually having started to matriculate yet. And because of the way that Hunter College is set up, it's amazing. It's part of the SUNY system, so you can go there relatively inexpensively. So yeah, there's, to me, like it's entirely plausible that she could have done that.
I'll be honest, I never thought of Donna being like that much younger, but it does actually kind of add what we're saying about Gerson is that there's those high expectations of like her sisters. And just being that third one, she probably feels like she would always like never be enough in that regard.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, we're talking a lot about like the Hayward situation, Ben Horn's head being split open. But I think even if that didn't happen, there would still be an uphill battle because you have someone who's like a genius. Even like in the show, I think it works because, Alicia Witt. In the interview with Scott Ryan that she did, she actually read Frank Herbert's Dune before she was actually, I think, to be at that young of an age and to comprehend Dune is remarkable. And for her to have like what is clearly gifted piano skills also carries over. But moreover to Gersten is that, if you're a genius and you feel like you're never enough, that's like enough to kind of get you into where you're at anyway. So I think if anything, that does kind of reaffirm what we're saying that like this was always going to happen. But I've honestly always thought that part with Donna early on was just like blatant, like just either blatantly wrong or just showing that Tammy's going off with bad information. But I will say is that at least for me, the final dossier, while I do challenge the veracity of a lot of the stuff that's in it, that at least all this stuff like being fluent in four languages, the breakdown in college, drugs, like this lines up pretty well with the return. And I guess before we really dive into the return, we kind of have to talk about Steven and Becky because Gerson's such like a large wedge that's driven between them. Like maybe, Becky doesn't seem like she knows about Gerson for a while, but this is
She
clearly
has her
like,
address.
but we have a lot to discuss about that dynamic of the relationship before we move on to Gerson, how she factors into Steven's life.
I do want to actually add one more character parallel. Like it's just something that like got stuck in my head. It's not from this movie. It's from the Philadelphia Story. There is a scene with so Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant, and there is a much younger actress, Virginia. totally blanking on her name, but who's also a prodigy. And she plays the much younger sister of Katharine Hepburn in this movie. And she's playing a heightened version of herself because there are reporters at the house. And she comes like dancing into a room and she's talking about all her accomplishments in this very, very heightened kind of way, like for effect. She sits down at the piano and she's like, and I'm going to regale you with, you know, such and such. And she sits down and plays this version of Lydia the Tattooed Lady that is so incredible. Like, it just, I keep thinking of the scene. In fact, when I was rewatching the scene for a second, it took me a second to remember, wait, did Gersten play Lydia the Tattooed Lady? But no, it was Get Happy. But there's just something about like the performative little sister coming in there. And I think, like, even this character in the Philadelphia Story is talking about saying, you know, I speak this, here are my accomplishments and things. So it wouldn't entirely surprise me if David Lynch somehow was thinking of this character. And she had been in another role as well, this particular actress, and she died tragically young. But there's such, like, kind of if you mashed Harriet and Gersten together, there's something in there. And I would not be surprised to find out if David Lynch had watched that and done a little bit of the modeling with it.
For the return, I do think is that it's probably good to mention like where we feel about Stephen and Becky Burnett, because these are, we'll say, flawed characters to put it mildly. But for me, I should probably say is that Stephen always looked like the worst one at any given turn, even without the whole like getting in her face, like a half key turn away from like hitting her. There's just something that like just the energy that he gave off, that he's just this like bad influence. Because you know, we start off with him where it's Mike Nelson is giving him like a dress down about how bad his resume is. He's clearly using a ton of drugs, and he's at least a partial factor of Becky going to Shelley for money. You know, and of course Shelley doesn't seem to have that much money to begin with, so she's just taking from her mother. Yeah, there's just a lot that's going on. Karl Rod, he notices, but there's only so much he can do as a landlord. Again, there's a lot about this relationship, but I feel like it's good to give context where we stand before we talk about Gersten in it.
Oh God, first of all, Karl Rod, truly one of my favorite characters throughout every single scene, just truly. And to have to, you know, have him interact with the malevolence that is Stephen is horrible. Stephen to me seems like he would perpetually be damp. There's always something wet about him. There's always a running sore, and he can't help it. Like, there is something that is born kind of oozing within him. I wish we had more backstory on him because he just seems like I can't imagine. I like to think of people sometimes, like, who were you when you were a child? You know, it's a question I always ask on, you know, the podcast I host, who were you when you were 10? And I can't think of him as ever having been clean. And this doesn't even have to do with, you know, his intake of substance or anything like this. Like, he was born with maybe something not fully cooked in him or something like that. Like, he was, because, you know, you think of Richard Horne and how he was always like this. And you get the sense that Stephen has never been a full person, like, that there's always been something, like, he was born to die in some particular way. And we still, again, like, don't entirely know if he is dead or not. We heard the shot, but then, you know, we read in the dossier that maybe he was hooked up in something else. You don't know. I don't think he intersected with Mr. C, but he is of Mr. C. He's sort of barely a force. He's a feels like a minion of something. And I don't know if that thing that is puppeting him is like something that seeped up from the lodge, like where it comes from. But I just can't really imagine. But I have to wonder the people, you know, the partners of his who we have seen him with. When I look at Becky, I know that she is using drugs, that she has all of these things going on with her, but I think of her as sort of angelically tidy and clean. And even though she's got these behaviors, and even though she's, you know, her mother's on the front of the car and all this, like, there's something almost like unsullyable about her, despite what she's fallen into. And anything that would happen to her would be because of him. He's this corrupting, corroding influence. And it feels to me that with the two of them, there was never a possible good outcome for him. But then, you know, you see somebody like Becky and you think about the history that we have with her parents. I mean, truly one of my other favorite characters ever is Bobby. And to see how he, you know, developed both because of and despite like the parents, you know, the Briggses and all these kind of things. Like, I think that's an incredible set of parents who he has. And once you find out their motivations kind of later on for things like the genuine affection and love that he seemed to have with them, and especially like the scenes with his mother and things, and the man he has turned into, to me, he is a force of exceptional good who is one of the shock and delights of the return. So that have the DNA of that, but also of like, you know, Shelley, who, you know, you get the sense that like she got corrupted by Leo, you know, that she was drawn down, that she was this potential force. I have to think that there is hope for their offspring, who is clearly loved and worried about by her parents. And Stephen is just this force that is going to somehow end up corroding and poisoning everything around him. I think she got yanked out in time, but their relationship is so depressing, deeply upsetting to me.
I think there's something about the contrast of the two, because there's that part when you see them outside the Double R Diner where she's like, despite the fact they're both dealing with severe addiction, there's something about her that, like, the way she dresses, like, everything has a certain color, it pops out. But they have Steven, who's like this disheveled mess, and he's supposed to be the more professional on that day because he's the one going for the interviews. He's offering her coke, he's asking in a very pathetic manner for a kiss. But then we have that scene with her where it's like, you know, the drugs are kicking in. And it's clearly a terrible thing, but the way that scene is played out, where it's like her looking up to the sky, it's fixated on her for at least a good minute or two. There is something a little more low bar, but more angelic about her compared to Steven.
There's something Lodge aligned to that as well to me, because she's looking up in that same way that you see Gersten do later, that you see people do when the sky is changing. So you wonder, even for her, if maybe the drugs she took like offered some sort of portal to, you know, maybe she's looking to the White Lodge. Who knows? Because I don't think of her as being, you know, sort of Black Lodge affiliated in that particular way. So I have to wonder, you know, drugs are a thing that affects people in different ways, and some people can just, you know, have fun and party, and for some people it bonds to some particular part of their psyche, their body, their makeup. Somehow, you know, addiction is very, very real. And for some people, they were always going to get addicted to something. It's just part of their makeup. And for some people, it's about a particular substance and it happens to affect them. I don't feel inherently with her like she had maybe necessarily an addictive personality. Maybe she's addicted to him in a way and something that he offers, but it's almost like the substance and he are situational rather than endemic. But maybe there's something in here that has these sensitivities, because I've never seen her have that moment where she's looking up, like, what is she seeing? But there is, but you're absolutely right with that angelic kind of thing. You know, Lynch loves his angels and his angels, his Glindas, his, you know, all of these things. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, in the larger extended universe of Lynch, you know, also, I love that performer. I love Amanda Seyfried so, so much. She had fulfilled somewhat of a similar role in Veronica Mars, where she was, you know, she was dead when it started, and she was the person whose death kicked everything into action there. What made the main character of Veronica Mars sort of turn from being like a, you know, popular cheerleader and stuff into somebody who was exploring her own trauma and all of this. And but she only exists in retrospect and then getting like basically, you know, getting murdered. So I sometimes wonder like what the connection is between those particular performances. And I realize that's tangential and stuff, but she is somebody who to me can kind of like exist in these varying places, but also has a voice from beyond. So she seems like a voice of light and purity in a way that I don't know. I just like her, and I think that actress is so deeply capable and fun and nuanced in it.
One of the things that you said was you're actually referring to anything that was Lodge adjacent. And I think it's perfect for Stephen, Becky, and Gersten as well, because I'm coming back to the Alicia Witt interview that Scott Ryan did. What she said is that based on what David told me, I sense that there's a lot of otherworldly stuff going on within those scenes. It's hard to even explain it. It felt like an out-of-body experience. And for me, I actually think of that with the final scene, but the way she talks about it is that she insinuates that this is in like all of her scenes. You know, granted, we have the scene with her at the apartment when Becky starts shooting at the door, but it seems like for you, it seems like you're referring to like these more Lodge adjacent aspects as something that's like permeating all of the return. For you, is it just something that's like you think about alongside while you watch the return, or is it just like set scenes that you think of in regards to Gersten?
It's for me, and what for me, it's everything Lynch. Like really, truly, it's the veil between these worlds and the characters who I sort of identify as possibly existing in both. It is not just her in any way. There are people who maybe are surprised that they inhabit both places, and some people for whom it is inevitable. Like, you know, that they would show up in the Red Room and be like, oh yeah, of course. Like, this is just what happens. Like, you know, they would thoroughly not be surprised, because I think there are some of them who are so earthbound and all of these things that you don't think that they would ever have any crossover or sensitivity to it. And then the people who do, and you're really quite surprised when they do as well. But there's something, I don't know if it's just in the performance. Like, I was really, really shocked when Andy turned out to be a person who existed throughout both of those things and had those interactions. You don't necessarily ever think that like Shelley is going to, or Ed in these ways, because they are this sort of so firmly fixed in this. But I think of other, you know, characters and other of Lynch's work, and they are, and I think it's especially because he uses so many of the same cast members that I can't help but think, you know, this is all one body of work together. And he is exceptionally gifted in finding the performers who he thinks can inhabit those multiple spaces. Like, clearly he does it with Kyle. Like, he, you know, and that is his avatar in all of these things. You see it with Grace Zabriskie, who in some of his other work is just the most terrifying possible thing. You know, you see it with like various of his things. And then you have to wonder for a second, like, are they just, you know, in the same way that there are tulpas of people and there are all of these other things, are they just existing in inhabiting bodies in other places? Or is it an entirely different actor in this other thing? It's the same spirit and they got spit into another body for something, you know? And so it's not just specifically Gersten and Stephen and Becky in this. It's an all over kind of thing. But I have to note also, this is also another triangle that there had been. If you think like with the parentage of Donna and like what created that. So you have Doc and Mrs. Hayward, and then you have Ben Horn as well. That's another trio right there, sort of unwittingly with the cheating. And all of a sudden this is replicated later. And you know, there's somebody involved. Like, I don't know. I feel like there's something, there's a Hayward involved somehow. I don't know what about Haywards that happened. Oh, actually, even with James, you know, it's, you know, so maybe there's something poly about the Haywards. I don't know, but they seem, there's something that ends up attracting things outside the maybe the parallel of like a two-person relationship and goes into these other forces whether they want to or not. I don't know. It's an interesting thing to me.
When I think of what Alicia Witt said, I do view that there's something otherworldly going on, but I don't necessarily think of it as much with the scene with Becky's shooting at the door. I think of that as like, I guess, a bit of a linear scene, but I really place emphasis on when Gersten and Steven are in the woods, because for me, I always think of like how important wind is to David Lynch's filmography. Even the early days, like the first thing that got him into motion pictures, that he thought he saw what looked like wind on his painting. And so it's something that's permeated his filmography and his art all around for decades. And moreover, at Twin Peaks, is that I always notice the wind is like some like underlying force in the original series, even Fire Walk Me. But I view the wind as a much more unwieldy, even terrifying force in The Return. Like with the way the trees are moving, that there's like this almost like angry sort of like motion, like far more than what we saw, you know, previously before The Return. And I think it's that with Gersten and Steven, they're in the heart of the woods. For the first time, I actually put subtitles on for the research of this episode to see just what they were actually saying. And I noticed that it seems like Gersten is at least a little more coherent than Steven, because there's the implication, admittedly, I never got myself, but there's the implication that Steven thinks that he killed Becky. And the thing is that Gersten asks why and insists she did it. I always thought she, as in Becky. So I think that already muddies the waters for me on like Becky's fate. But the two things that she says is that she says that you were stoned, and he says a little bit more. But then she says like a concern of like, what the fuck did she give you? Like insinuating that it's actually Becky gave Steven something. And I think that says something about the relationship of like how Gersten views Steven as almost like someone she has to almost protect. Like, because there's clearly like an age difference between them, because she would be like probably mid-late 30s and he's early mid-20s. And there's just something about how she's trying to be there for him, even though he's like this disheveled mess. He thinks he's killed someone. He's clearly got a gun on him. I know there's a lot to go and unpack with the scene, but what were your thoughts about this?
She's doing the same thing she always has. She is being there to be an emotional sponge for somebody who is wrecked. This is her wheelhouse. This is what she grew up in. She grew up being this force in her own home. And with, again, she was taking care of adults there because she was taught to. I think she was very protective of her mother as her mother moved throughout the world. She and her sister, again, like had the notion to throw this dinner party for these adults who needed comforting. She used her art to take care of them as Leland is going off and getting faster and manically singing this thing. She's trying to catch up with all of this. He is a person who is clearly spiraling and drawing all of this. This is just what she does. It's who she was brought up to be. Again, what again, an inevitable thing for a character. The fact that she would see somebody who is shuddering and in pain and may have killed somebody, like the other person who she was comforting, she sees that. And even if she doesn't know, she inherently knows that this person did something. And no matter what it is, she's not going to judge. She's just going to make it, she's going to try to make it better and soothe them. I mean, I keep thinking about, like, she is older than him. So I wonder, I assume they know each other because of drugs, but I saw somebody theorize, like, did she teach him in high school? Did she give him music lessons? Did she, I can't see him as anything other, he was a high school graduate, as he kept asserting, like during this, which, and the way he was saying it, it's like he assumed that she would know this about him. So you wonder how far back these families have been entwined also, because it seems like Becky knew exactly where she was going to apartment 208, I believe it was. And to me, like, there wasn't the wind, but you saw the spiral of the staircase going up to there. And that's not somewhere for Gersten being as much of kind of a mess as we see her in some of these. The hallways and things, those were kind of nice. And I thought, like, okay, so maybe she does something, like she has some sort of job or that maybe she can maintain that allows her to live in this apartment and do it somewhat independently. But they're going around this staircase and it comes up to this static door. There is the neighbor who clearly has seen her before and saying, like, they're not there, they have left, they're not there. And then there's the wall of the door in front of them, and suddenly it is permeated by, I believe it is, six shots. And that is where the disruption comes in there. She is the force that happens there. Also makes me wonder, how does Becky know how to use a gun like that? She is sure stanced there. She's not just like, ah, she's done this before. She's had target practice before. What in her life made her, think that they do not seem to come from a hunting people so much. It doesn't necessarily seem like something she would have done. And also, that's a handgun, that's not a hunting rifle. So what in her life led her to the place where she learned how to be really adept with a firearm like that? That's, it makes me think that this is a something that has played out before, that she has known that Stephen has had relationships with other people as well, that maybe she had to have something for self-defense. That she, when she goes up there, yeah, she's willy-nilly when she's on her way there. She injures her mother on the front of the car when she is doing this, but she knows where she's going and she knows what she's going to do when she gets there.
Yeah, that's something that's worth addressing, is that how she's like, how good she is with the gun. But I think the one thing that I was thinking about is that when you said room 208, I'm not sure this pertains to Gerson or the scene in general, but I think of how important numerology is to Lynch, and the fact that 208 adds up to 10, the number of completion. So this does actually kind of tie into the whole what Alicia Witt said, that there is stock in the idea that there's something otherworldly going on. Again, not sure if it's the room or Gerson, but there's something that is worth saying about that scene and where Gerson's at this point.
Oh yeah, and the thing is, like, yes, I know, like, apartments have numbers on the front of them and stuff like that, but this was like, I took note of that. And actually, it just occurred to me, her dad probably taught her how to shoot. He's a cop, so.
One thing I will say is that when you said that, like how she's trained with a gun, the thing I was actually thinking about is that Bobby says to her at the double R is that the only reason why you're not in a holding cell is because I'm part of the sheriff station. So she probably got away with like less worse offenses or stuff that never got back to him, like from, I don't know, an age of when Bobby himself was misbehaving. Because if we're going with the secret diary and fire walking, he's
Oh
killed
yeah.
people himself. So If she's good with a gun, like better
Did he
with
kill
him, like,
the person? We don't
yeah. So
know.
I didn't even think about that with Becky, about like the fact that the implication of how good she is with a gun, and the fact that Steven, probably more so than Gersu, would have known to get out of there just in time.
So yes, they were already, how were they listening to the police band? Because they're taking calls about like the, I mean, I guess though that comes in after. Oh, you know what? Actually, no, her mom was in the van with Carl and they were calling in. So it wouldn't surprise me if Stephen is involved in drug enterprise and he spends a lot of time with Becky. And we don't know how involved Becky is in his business, but I get the sense that she's played decoy. She has had to do various things that maybe she wouldn't have otherwise, but she loves her man there. Maybe there's, I don't know. Actually, I'm conflating that, but like, I think something came out over the band there. Maybe Gersten is like, because if that was her apartment, maybe she is somehow listening to something. Maybe he is listening in somehow because he needs to know what is happening because he leads such a precarious life and because he does things. So maybe they have gotten something, but they did have some indication. Maybe there was a phone call made. Maybe somebody like tipped off Gersten to this. But I know that when they were on the way over in the van, it had been known that she had taken off in the car. So there must have been some sort of advance notice that happened there to make them go and cower in the stairwell. So something had happened, but this has happened again. This has happened before. This will happen again. How many times has this played out?
The other thing I was thinking of is that, because we were talking about the dynamic of Steven and Gersten, it seems like they know each other kind of well, but also not well enough, because he says that he's a high school graduate, and the first thing that Gersten says is fuck, like clearly not happy about that realization. Do you think that was something that Steven, like, he was lying about being like a college graduate, or do you think that was just a conversation that they never had? Because for me, I just feel like that was a conversation that they just never had.
I think they were both really high. I sort of just, I felt like she was almost registering to something else and not when he was saying, because they were not in the same plane of existence when all of this was happening. He's talking about what, rhinoceros or something. So he could be saying absolutely anything. So I don't think, I mean, I think they clearly knew. They had an existing relationship, but I think there are particular relationships that are based on use of substances that maybe make some of the other factors that usually would be in a relationship, less relevant. Like, doesn't matter if you like the same movies or whatever. Like, I remember asking about somebody, like, oh, how does he know him? Oh, he knows him from drugs. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. And then he says, to her, I like effing you. So clearly they have a sexual relationship as well. But I think maybe, I don't know if she was, if like Gersten was going to score and he was the source, because you do get, the sense, I think it's even said in the dossier that that is, he's like the primary like source of drugs to people because this is all flowing through him. And I believe was he working with Richard Horne? And so it's all sort of tied together. But I think if people are both in a situation where they're in love with something that is not them, they're in love with the substance. And I think that's going to transcend cultural and age differences and make them behave in a way that they may not have otherwise necessarily. So I don't think she's reacting to him saying, I'm a high school graduate. And I think that may have just been on his mind because he was in the job application process there and Mike had been excoriating him as he, I just want Mike to yell at so many people. Mike should just dress down so many people, really.
I guess either way, with the high school graduate part, I think for her, it ultimately doesn't undermine how she feels about him, because she's sobbing and cries shakily as he's like losing his mind as the scene's going on. Because I still think that Gerson comes across as the more coherent of the two,
Oh,
but it just
yeah.
seems like Steven's getting way worse. And for me, it's like, yes, drugs for me are almost unquestionably a factor, but I think there's something about how unwieldy the wind and then the trees, that there's something that's like really nefarious than Twin Peaks, and that like the what we knew in the original series, even though that had a seedy underbelly, it is worse tenfold. I think a character like Red, for example, kind of shows that, because it makes it seem like he was around in Twin Peaks for like only a couple weeks before the events of the return. So it's not crazy for me to say that maybe he had this like horrible influence that, of course, we saw only someone with Richard Horne, but he's Dane Shelley, that this is someone else who had to deal with Leo in the past. It's not crazy to think that Red would have at least a tangential association with Stephen, Becky, or Gersten. And again, like, I guess that, Sparkle, maybe the effects of it are like almost secondary to what's going on with like the trees and the wind, and also just the general sickness all around we see in Twin Peaks. So I think that for him, if I had to say, he's a small part of a larger picture of why Gersten and Steven are where they're at.
Yeah, because I feel like with Red, I mean, there clearly was something established. The fact that he could set up basically an epicenter of moving around drugs there meant that there was a lot of use, that people there were going to be a lot of consumers, I mean, which there always have been. Cocaine was such a huge factor in the original series, so there's always been that want, and I wonder if some of that want is exacerbated by the fact that it is so lodge adjacent on a hellmouth, that kind of thing. So I really think it acts as this gravitational force for people who might be exhibiting all of these things anyway. They find themselves brought there, and then I think it's this sort of engine that feeds itself. And then once you have more people who are perhaps altered by substance use, and it's breaking down some of their maybe some of the guardrails that they would have had before about what is acceptable in society, I think it erodes some of that, and maybe people are a little bit more susceptible to things. Like, I'm thinking even in that first scene, once the adults are sort of maybe what more well lubricated, that they've each had at least a cocktail and they moved on to wine, and some of that is broken down, like it is at the Roadhouse, where people are going there to get intoxicated and do all of these things. These things have always been a part of Twin Peaks. And then I have to wonder then, with the drug trade moving from Canada effectively down there in this more robust way, now that there's like things can be technologically enabled, and once you get, the police, corruptible people from the police force more involved in it, I think everything has, you're absolutely right, that like the electrical charge has been building up there this whole time. I mean, and also we've seen just like in, actual real life society now too, like the corrosive effect that opioids and various other things have had on towns that maybe, before were just very, very normal, and they've given this different want to people. And in a way that ends up becoming it pulls people into it who, had they never met this particular substance, their lives would have been entirely different. And I think in Twin Peaks, there's, there are both drugs, there's Garmon Bozia, there's all of these things. And, again, as I was saying, there were people who they were going to be addicted to something no matter what. And then for some people, they find a particular substance that is their thing. I think in Twin Peaks, there is that. Twin Peaks is the substance, the Garmon Bozia that comes up through it, the sort of the oil of it all, the dark stinking oil of it all. I think that there is something that unlocks something within particular people. And it is deeply, I don't know where Steven was born, but I would not be surprised if he was born of that somehow, and like oozed up in the same kind of way.
This is more, again, albeit tangential, but still pertain to the world that Gersten is in at this point, is that I think of like the sociopolitical connotations that Mark Frost has in The Return and the Final Dossier regarding her, is that, I think of in the original series, we had Jean Reno, where it was like a trickle down, where it was his brothers and Leo Johnson, Bobby and Mike. They're the ones that distributed the drugs, but sort of like, they just kind of knew who to give it to. But when you look at something like Red, it's like far more organized. There's like military grade weapons that are prominently displayed. There's like more of like a crew. There's feels like there's more of a uniformity to it. Red is a much more idiosyncratic character than Jean Reno. So it's just like Twin Peaks is just a completely different world from what Gerson grew up in, like, during the original series. So the problems that we're dealing that, that like Shelley or Bobby or anyone who's dealing with at that time is like far different, actually far worse for Gersten. And come back around is that she's like someone who's a genius and has these like feels like she's never fulfilling these unrealistic expectations. So we're just seeing someone at like a final breaking point in this final scene with her.
There's that whole sort of theory of the gifted child, and people who are maybe prodigies in youth, and the kind of pressures that can be put on there, and all of that expectation and that focus that happens, where maybe they get all this adulation and love for their accomplishments rather than like their personhood, and they might feel as if they have to achieve, because maybe that's what people are talking about for them. They're talking about their achievements rather than who they are, and it can become a really painful thing for some people, later in life. When I was younger, when I was in the 8th grade, I was in the National Spelling Bee, and I did well once I finally got there. But it made me really, really interested in the culture of the spelling bee. And it turned out, I sort of looked into a lot of the past winners and things, And it was finding that people who had ended up in the top, several slots of that over the years had maybe then gotten into adult life and things and ended up having like some pretty big collapses or like really, really struggled with some things because they really thrived in the structure of school and in these academic competitions and stuff. And then you get out into the real world and maybe you're the person at your school who has these particular abilities, but then you get somewhere like where she went, like Stanford, where everybody was the standout in their class. You're all of a sudden not special because everybody speaks four languages or does all of these things. And that structure that you had of being the pinnacle is all of a sudden gone. So if you're a person who maybe has come from these traumatic revelations about your family and, and everything that you had taken and accepted as real, maybe it turns out not to be, and you're dealing with these traumas, and also like it's hard being away from home. A lot of people have collapses when they move to college, and some of them go back and some of them don't. But it all very much tracks to me, as well as especially for somebody who is, then again, we know she was a very, very gifted pianist. Like that's just inherent there too, but like the math and English kind of stuff, like was she somebody who did that because she inherently like knew these things, was a good scholar, or did she do it because she pushed and pushed and pushed herself? Like did she work to get there? Was this just in her? And you get the sense that this character has rehearsed the piano a lot, but there's something within that performance, also like there is just incredible talent in addition to the discipline. So, this all kind of tracks that she might get away and then break down and then come back to this place where there are these factors. And now also, with that drug trade changing so much, at that point, there probably weren't as many synthetic things out there being manufactured. And so just the sheer volume of things that could come through was much smaller. It's not like you could have, like, there's only a certain amount of cocaine that is going to happen. There's only a certain amount of heroin that's going to happen because you can only grow so many poppies. But with these, synthetic opioids, those can be endlessly manufactured. And so for somebody like Red, there's just more for him to distribute. And because these drugs are so highly addictive, he can grow his customer base. And that is what he is really deeply interested in. So it doesn't actually really surprise me, especially if the mill is closed down, especially if there are all these other things that's economically depressed. Where else are people going to be making their money? They're going to be turning to something like that. So it doesn't really surprise me that the trade has taken over like that.
Actually, this one, we don't really see Gerson affiliated with food throughout the return, but it is something I think is worth addressing on this note because you were mentioning synthetic drugs. I was thinking about how they do that with food throughout the return. Like, for example, we see Chad with two TV dinners. We see Sarah Palmer. She's like, clearly eating nothing that's really, it's not exactly what would be deemed as natural. We have Norma at the Double R Diner where she's talking about how everything's like locally made, it's all organic. And that it feels like that's what makes the Double R so special. But you see all these other aspects of food that are shown in a more processed and unnatural way. And I think there's a correlation with like the drug aspect, how that can kind of tie into Gerson in particular.
Yeah, and the fact that the great conflict with Norma's is they're trying to get her to cheap out on the natural stuff there, and that was not going to fly with her ever. And again, she is a person who I think of as being one of those very sort of like earthbound kind of characters, so it wouldn't occur to her to shortcut on any of that. That was always going to be real. You have a connoisseur like Coop who comes through there, and he can taste it and he can feel it with that meal that they have. For the supper club, as much as it does not, align with my particular taste, I just have a particular, I know I brought it up, like cooked carrots are just like kind of my kryptonite. And also I don't care for mashed potatoes or peas. So to see all of those there, it was like my nightmare meal kind of. But somebody made that and they made it with such tremendous care. And they do keep going back to like the food at the diner over and over again. And that we have these significant moments that you, I'm trying to remember, there was a steak dinner somewhere, but like, yeah, you have those notions when people are being brought back to the reality. And, obviously within the baked goods of it all, that those are always such a totem there, that the people who I think of as being very, aligned, like, Sheriff Truman, like the original Sheriff Truman, and Andy, though we find, he transcends eventually, and Coop, like, donuts are such this pure pleasure of it. Can you even imagine trying to bring a half-assed donut into that station? That is never ever going to fly. You see Gordon Cole being a person who truly appreciates the pleasures of like a really, really good wine, that is something that he deeply responds to. And you can't fake that. And that really, really stands out to me that he's, somebody who's going to have that. There's something in the purity of like the milk that Harriet is having at the table. So yeah, you do see people having these particular moments, and you're absolutely right to call out that synthetic versus the made with love and care kind of thing. I hadn't noticed that before. That's a really good observation.
The last note that I have is that we're coming back to the scene in the woods where Cyril Ponce, played by Mark Frost, he scares both of them, mostly because they clearly have a gun and he was just walking through not expecting that. And that seems to prompt Stephen to shoot himself. And Gerson is, she's not doing well with everything that's going on before that. And we cut to Cyril Ponce going up to Carl Rodd to tell him about what happened. And it's clearly pointing to the trailer, because so he clearly, he lives in the new Fat Tout trailer park. And I think that for Cyril Ponce, I think if there's a connection, he has one more so with Carl Rodd rather than Stephen Gerson. But did you have any thoughts about this scene and how it all played out?
Yeah, so Carl is eternal also. I mean, he's been to the other side, as we find out later, that he was one of the, I think it was three school children who were brought over and spent some time there and has that mark. So he is somebody who is sensitive to all of this. He is one of the most compassionate people in this whole thing, like the young man who can't pay his rent. So, Carl gets exasperated, but he's kind. I mean, my husband and I, like Twin Peaks is such a thing with us, and we repeat the lines like, "Where's my goddamn hot water?" And he doesn't want to be woken up before a certain hour of the morning, and cup of wake up, good morning America, or whatever it is. Like, he's so tied to his coffee and his relationship with it. Like, to me, he is such a beautiful and grounding force, and he's a White Lodge person to me. Again, we know that he has sort of transcended the veil there too, but he is so aligned as a force of good and kindness and compassion. He clearly has heard Becky and Stephen a million times fighting. The cops have been called out there how many times? It's the trailer is still wrecked when Cyril Ponce like comes through there, and he sees it, and he's showing tremendous compassion to Shelley as she's in the van, like, because he knows what the force of all of this is, and he believes everybody, and he is kind and compassionate. It really strikes me that he is just somebody who people come to be grounded. He is a problem solver, and he is this force of kindness and good. And he is clearly also, I feel like the trailer park has moved up, because I feel like it had been smaller before and it got to be a thing. And and he is the person grounding that. And I was actually really glad that, I can't not think of him as Mark Frost. Like, Mark Frost and his dog, found safe harbor there too. But to have him be the person who goes and finds disruption in the woods, because I can't help but think he was drawn to that tree where this was happening, and that his dog also was. Maybe this is part of his regular route. I don't know. I mean, it seems like it could easily be a well-trodden path through there. But because he is this character who, again, like, it is to me very deliberate that he is played by Mark Frost. That is a thing, because it ties it to, it fixes it extra in canon in my head, because I know that that was signed off on by the auteur to go through and find this thing and to put this scene in this very significant relationship to me, where that is a place where the veil is very thin in those particular woods, and that they have found the grounding against that tree, and that once again, for the third time, unless my eyes were tricking me in the stairwell scene, she's wearing pink again. She is wearing that, obviously, in that first scene where she's dressed like, Glinda, and wearing the pink dress. She is wearing a bomber jacket in the stairwell. That red, I mean, it could be gray, it could, whatever, but it looked pinkish to me. And in this, she is so significantly dressed, because she is wearing this sort of pink, or sort of magenta, whatever. And I saw somebody refer to it as a red shirt. I'm like, no, that is a pink shirt with Western detail on it. She is wearing what looks to be sort of slightly pink laces on her boots halfway up. She's wearing a hot pink bra while she is doing this as well. And she has a key around her neck. And that's not the only time a key is happening there as well. Somebody is asking, you know, I'd seen a theory about this where Mr. C was needing to get the key from, as they called her, the bosomy woman, to get in and talk to Philip Jeffries. So there is a key that is being held by somebody. And this, again, like, to me, points to Gersten being somebody who is, you know, can travel between these worlds, and makes me wonder if she is somehow an entree into between them as well, because she's got this key. It's never explained where the key is from, but it is clearly, it is such a significant thing. And I'm trying to remember if she's wearing it in the stairwell as well. It, you know, it's like lighting isn't as good. I think she is actually, she is wearing a key in there as, but the fact that she has it, you don't just sort of like half-assedly like wear a key. It's not a key necklace. It's a key that she has in a chain that is, it's not a ball chain, but it's somehow, you know, not unlike one of those two. It is something that she has put together to keep a key around her neck. What does that go to? You know, what is he unlocked? Like, as they're going through the scene and breaking down, you know, her shirt opens up. Like, you see her bra, there's the key, and it is like on top of her breast. There is something incredibly significant about that to me. I was looking at her hand. She's wearing rings. The rings are both on her pointer fingers. There's no insignia on them that I can see. I was looking for the owl. Like, I was looking at all of these. There is a stone in one of them, and she's got sort of lavender nails as well. And it's such an interesting thing, because she's a person who, well, we know she's in so much chaos because she's been, you know, struggling with her mental health and clearly some substance use disorder as well. There are parts of her that are incredibly clean and well presented. She looks clean again as well. Like, her outfit doesn't look dirty. Like, her shirt looks like it has been, you know, washed or pressed or something. Her boots are a little haphazardly laced, but her nails are done. You know, they're not chipped, they're not messy. She's got nail polish on. All of these little details are in place. She looks, you know, a little bit, you know, distraught and things too, but she is somehow, again, this person who, not for the first time in her life, is comforting somebody who is in chaos. So I have to think there's some part of her life that is still highly organized and neat, like, you know, some of these indicators of what her apartment probably looks like on the inside from, you know, how it looks outside in there. But the fact that she took the time to do her nails very, very well, and that she has a clean shirt on, these details make me think those are kind of the earthbound things of it. But the fact that all of the colors and everything like that are still echoing that first person who she was, she's, that's still there. There's something of original Gersten that is still in there. And that kind of gives me hope, because it's also noted that she isn't seen again after that. So I don't know if she's been subsumed somewhere else or if she got away. It's hard to tell.
I think you might be honest on, because I think that is part 15. That's the same episode where Mr. C, he goes convenience store, goes to Dutchman's, talks to Philip Jeffries, and even at the end of that episode, it's after the Asian girl screams after the two guys like pull her out from the booth at the Roadhouse, and it cuts to the exterior of the Dutchman's, you know, because we were talking about the key in particular. And of course, Mr. C needed a key to get in that room to begin with. Do you think there's any connection to Gersten in regards to that final part of part 15?
I absolutely do. I think she's unlocking something. We also don't see Steven again, because while we did hear a gun, he's either on the lam or he's disappeared. We would have heard if his body had been found in the woods, but he's not. They're looking out, you know, for him in the world somehow. So I can't help but think, again, because we talk about these sort of characters inhabiting, you know, actors play different versions of themselves, but also I think that there are some people who they can be multiple people. Like, there are tulpas out there that are a physical representation of somebody, but I think that there are also people who maybe can inhabit different kinds of bodies and stuff like that. So, you know, I had seen this theory put out there somewhere, so I, you know, didn't come up with this myself, but it made me start thinking about how maybe she's also the bosomy woman. Maybe she is also giving passage to somewhere, because there is the deliberate mention of a key and needing to be let in. So she maybe is some sort of portal to something, but it's another thing that makes me think that she inhabits multiple places. And maybe that's why she goes missing sometimes.
That's actually a great observation, because in the final dossier, Tammy doesn't say anything about Stephen dying, at least on that last page of the Hayward segment. And I thought that when it said that Gerson was not seen after that, I thought it was like maybe she went back to Vermont like to see Doc Hayward, because by this point Donna patched things up with him. Maybe she just wanted to very much desperately after the events of the final dossier, just want to start a new life. But this stuff about the key, I think there's something important to that. And the fact that Alicia Witt could sense that there was some otherworldly things going on, I think there's a lot to be said about the fact that there is something more Lodge adjacent that she's dealing with.
Oh, absolutely. And once Sorrel Pons comes through with his dog and then runs away, and Stephen is pulling out the gun with potential to use, and and all the things he was saying before about, I copied this from somewhere, there is the words for it. He's talking about rhinoceroses and coming up and all of these things, but he's saying, let's see, he's saying, like, I'm a high school graduate. I mean, God, where will I be? Will I be with a rhinoceros? The lightning in the bottle? Will I be completely like turquoise? While he is in this state, is he babbling or is he seeing something on the other side of the veil when he is doing this? I don't know what the connection with the rhinoceros is. It's this like Ionesco absurdism or something like that. Maybe there's something in there, but you can't help but wonder if maybe the drugs have unlocked something in there and he's, seeing this other thing. So she runs around to the other side of the tree and she's breathing and she's terrified and she hears the shot. She isn't sure entirely what happened. We are never shown this, but the way that she is looking up, and it's sort of blurry above her because of the canopy of trees, but in the same way that we have seen the sky in those places where it is permeable and we know it, and people have gone through when they have visited those touch points around, like where the character who I'm blanking on his name, but they brought him out there, and then his head came off. They went to this community, and you hear all of these buzzing, and then people are very, they need to be tethered to earth so they don't go up into the sky, and up into that thing. I think when she is looking up, and there's this sort of blurriness of the sky, there's the potential that maybe they're brought up through there in the same way that Andy was told to go to that particular spot and looks up, and all of a sudden it's permeable and the veil is thin, and he goes through and talks to the firemen. Maybe it's ridiculous, but then again, there's nothing so ridiculous in this world. I think that maybe he, made the attempt that brought him close to death or something like that. I would not be surprised if her as a kid, like, brought him through, transported him off to the lodge somewhere, and they both are gone.
I mean, I knew that there was going to be a certain ambiguity to Gerson's fate after this, but I didn't think of anything that would be like in this realm. So that's a lot to really think about.
All things are possible. And it really is that particular looking up at the sky in that way. And I know that Frost and Lynch, like, they really like to play with the movement of the trees, as you say, like caused by the wind and the whoosh. And they like to play with that, and they like to play with electricity. And there's a particular way that, like, the canopy of trees was moving, but almost in this kind of blurry sort of way. And we see people go in and out of forests, and that, you go into the circle of pines, you do all of these things, and you have to get past that in some way. And the other thing that comes to mind, like, the ending of The Good Place, where hopefully people listen, but there's a scene kind of in a forest, and then that also is somewhere where you can kind of go to another realm by, like, walking through a particular barrier of things. I think the way that she is looking up, in the same way that Becky has, she's high in the car and she's looking up, and who knows what she sees, and the way the various other people, I'm thinking of, like, when Andy was brought up, did he look up into the sky? There's just a particular tell when people look up, and you think, like, what are they seeing up there? How did they go through? I feel like Major Briggs had gone up through something as well when he had gone. And it just really strikes me that it wasn't just like a quotidian death that they had there. There was some sort of transcendence. And where do to me, Gersten's so innocent in so many ways, and she had so much up against her. And I just feel real pathos for her. The fact that she is wearing all that pink like she always did as a kid, there's something that she needs. She wants to have that kind of that innocence and that sweetness. Stephen, I don't think ever had a chance. He was in the same way that Richard Horne never had a chance. Like, he was born into that. He was born of Germán Bozzia. It sort of, like, bubbled up from there. But I don't know if two forces can cancel out each other. I don't know if Laura can, negate a Bob. But I know that that universe is very much about the balancing forces of things, and that the lodge and its inhabitants are very invested in the balance of things that play out down on Earth. Like, you get when, the reactor, like, unleashes a Jaudet onto the Earth, you send a Laura. So I can't help but think that Gersten and Steven are these forces that might bring each other into a particular clash, but then can she make him transcend into somewhere else, or is she just going to bring him up there and he's going to bleed out into the red room? I don't know.
Wow. I think that I said everything in my end about Gersten, but were there any final thoughts about anything beyond what we were talking about today?
You know what? I know this is so silly, but I feel so happy that Harriet ended up okay. And I wonder what protected her. And that's sort of the thing that I'm left with, because it seems like she ended up solid. It feels like Donna even did to some degree. Like she went through so much and so much pain and so much loss and betrayal and all of this. And I feel for that family so tremendously, both of the parents who I think did their best, even if they misstepped and they did these things, I think they did their best to try to shield their daughters from as much as they possibly could. Donna, she tried so hard. She tried to save Laura. She really, really tried, and she lost herself in parts of this. And I feel like they talk about how she's active in like the recovery community and trying to help people as well. And I think that is really significant and special. And that you get that caretaker thing from Gersten as well. She wants to save people. She wants things to be okay. She just wants to like sing and make people happy and make them dinner. It really strikes me that Harriet went off and she takes care of animals. They're pure, they sense things and stuff. And I think she needed to go and be among that sort of nature and that kind of healing because she knew that there was a finite thing that she could do there. And I think just all in all, like my empathy for the Hayward family is really especially brought home in Harriet and in Gersten. And maybe it's just me making myself feel better, but I like to think that maybe Gersten gets some peace at some point. I like to think that she pops up somewhere else in the grand Lynchian universe and she is being a force for good. Maybe she gets to go be Glinda. Like that would make me so happy because we know how Lynch regards Oz and how he regards Glinda and her as this pull and force of good into magic and protection. And I like to think that I know that there are theories that I have heard as well that Gersten in this alternate universe where it is found out that Laura just went missing, that things are rewritten, that in this sort of it would have to be a strange timeline, but that Gersten is eventually the person found wrapped in plastic. I don't want that fate for her. I'd like to think that she, like we see Laura being lifted up into this angelic circumstance at the end, and Laura hopefully can be safe, though now with the rewritten ending, we don't really know. I like to think that Gersten, because she did, like Laura, try so hard to take care of people, that she is this force of benevolence and good out into the world. And that's what I hope for Gersten.
That's a great way to end it. I think that I said everything on my end, but now that we're winding down, did you have anything you want to plug in terms of what you're working on, social media, or anything else of that nature?
Oh gosh, I mean, I'm always thrilled if people want to check out my book. It is called High Anxiety: Life with a Bad Case of Nerves. It's spelled like HI, like high anxiety, that I wrote, and it's all about my experience with anxiety, as it says in the title, over the years. And any of my work on food and wine, where I try as much as I can. I write about food, but I write a lot about the intersection of mental health and the food world. Just got renewed for a second season of Tinfoil Swans. You actually had a really great notion of something that now I'm going to try to speak into existence because Kyle MacLachlan is a tremendous producer of wine, and I've had the pleasure and the privilege of getting to interview him before. Hopefully, I can have him as a guest. But I want to thank you so much for what you do, for caring as much as you do, and giving so much nuance and platform to people, because like this is something that has been a passion of mine for since I was Laura Palmer's age, and you and the community that you build and that Twin Peaks brings into people's lives. It's so special to me. So I really want to thank you, and I want to thank anybody who's listening to this and cares all these years in and shares and stuff like that. It really means the world to me because y'all are my people.
And I want to thank you as well because you brought in a ton of insight to a character that I would have otherwise overlooked. Because, yeah, Gerson's a character who has very little screen time, but there's something about her dress as the Good Witch and then all these little things of like the trees that I knew that was like special to her, but I didn't think of the magnitude until this recording.
Oh, well, you gave me a chance to think about her in a way that I felt really privileged to do that. So I'm just so excited. And oh, and I also, if people want to follow me on, I'm mostly on Instagram, and it's just my full name, just Kat Kinsman for most of my, I'm barely on X anymore. That's Kitten with a Whip, the site formerly known as Twitter or something. But otherwise, just I'm glad to know folks are out there and consuming, you know, what you do, because it's really, really special to me, and hope to see everybody in the White Lodge one day.
And I'll be sure to put everything you mentioned in the show notes. But I just want to, before I sign off, thank you for coming on.
Truly, truly my pleasure. I can't think of a better way to spend an afternoon than to talk with you about something that is dear to my heart.
Together.